Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. The Trump administration's Department of Justice has plans to investigate and possibly sue colleges and universities that discriminate against white applicants. That's according to the internal document recently obtained by the New York Times. Although the Justice Department denies the Times' reporting, it has reopened the debate over affirmative action policies in college admissions. Joining me is national correspondent for higher education at the New York Times, Anamona Hartakolis. Anamona, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Gail. Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the very beginning. What exactly is the Department of Justice looking at with regard to affirmative action, even though it may not be citing this case, but what are they looking at in regard to affirmative action?
Sure. So the document reported in the Times was a job posting for lawyers who would investigate and possibly litigate race-based discrimination in colleges and universities. And what the Justice Department has acknowledged, has said, is that they are looking into one specific case of a complaint by 64 Asian American organizations filed against Harvard University, or they've acknowledged that they're looking into a complaint that fits that profile of 64 Asian American organizations suing Harvard or complaining about Harvard.
And what's the complaint allege?
So the complaint was filed in May of 2015. It tracks very closely to a lawsuit that was filed in Boston Federal Court a few months earlier in November of 2014, and it makes the case that Harvard is limiting Asian American enrollment, that they're actually discriminating against Asians who look better than other applicants. And year after year after year, admitting a similar number of Asians, African Americans, Hispanics, et cetera, in a fashion that looks very much like a quota.
So strictly by merit, Asian Americans allege that they would rise to the top and there should be more students at Harvard. Is that the basis?
They are saying that, if there were race-neutral admissions at Harvard, the percentage of Asian Americans there would look more like the percentage of Asian Americans at, say, the University of California at Berkeley, where there's a state law against affirmative action, and the percentage of Asian American students or Asian students is about upwards of 30%. At Harvard, it's 22%.
Are they trying to correlate it to the number of Asian Americans in the U.S.?
No, and this is a controversial point in the affirmative action debate. So, you know, how do you decide what's the right number? Should it be correlated to the proportion of people in that group in that population? And I think the people who filed this lawsuit would say that would be another form of numerical quotas. B, that would severely limit the achievement, the opportunity for minorities who outscore their percentage of the population. And that's Asian Americans. It's also Jews. There was a quota, informal quota against Jews at Harvard in the 20s, 30s, and possibly other minorities as well.
When you're talking about Asian Americans, what groups are involved here, Anamona?
So the reason there are 64 groups is because Asian Americans are not monolithic. So they cover the panoply. I'm not sure that it's exhaustive, but we could be talking about people from India or Pakistan or China or Korea. There are a variety of groups included.
We're talking about affirmative action this morning. My guest, Anamona Hartakolis, a national correspondent for higher education at the New York Times. This Harvard lawsuit, Anamone, is Harvard the only university accused of this type of discrimination?
No, not at all. In fact, similar groups or the same groups have challenged admissions at Princeton. And that case was decided in Princeton's favor by the Justice Department under the Obama administration. They've also challenged admissions at Dartmouth Brown, another university where there are relatively lower, slightly lower percentage of Asian Americans. So, no, Harvard is not unique, and it's not the only place being challenged on this.
You mentioned earlier the state schools in California. What about state schools in general? What's been the diversity initiative in state schools? Is it similar?
It is similar, I would say. California, the numbers in California are influenced by the fact, I think, also that there are large numbers of Asians in California. So in a state school in California, you're going to have larger numbers of Asian applicants. In a state school in, I don't know, Iowa.
Right. It just stands to reason,
Missouri,
basically.
You might not. So, I mean, that's part of the heart of the lawsuit, that the numbers at Harvard are fairly unchanging, even though you would expect fluctuations in the number of applicants and the qualifications of those applicants. And I have to say that on the other side, Harvard is saying that they are not making quotas. They're looking for a distribution across the range of groups, and they're proud of what they've achieved. So that's kind of the heart of the dispute. Are they doing it wrong or are they doing it right?
And Harvard is saying we need all type of student in order to make the educational environment viable.
Harvard is saying that education benefits from diversity, that there are all kinds of diversity, that race and ethnicity are one element of diversity, politics, political beliefs, religious beliefs, diversity of ideas, maybe other types of diversity that they look for, geographic diversity, socioeconomic diversity, so that this is one element in a bigger constellation of factors that constitute, that they look at in order to create a diverse class.
So speaking of diversity, I read this statistic, and tell me if it's correct. For the first time in Harvard's history, the incoming class is non-white, the majority.
And that
statistic is true for many elite colleges today.
It's true for many elite colleges, and you're including 22% Asians. So, I mean, it's not that surprising. Whites still form the biggest single component of the class. So, I guess what Harvard would tell you is it shows that they've been achieving their goals.
What progress have we seen since affirmative action? Did the idea prove to be worthwhile? Is it still worthwhile?
Oh, you're asking me, and that's not my call to make. But the Supreme Court has endorsed affirmative action. So it is now under certain conditions. So it is now the law of the land, and that was upheld as recently as about a year ago in the Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin case. And what the Supreme Court has consistently said is that numeric quotas are forbidden, but that race can be used as one factor in a constellation of factors to decide on admissions. And so, again, you're getting back to the heart of the dispute at Harvard and other institutions like it, which is, does the consistency of the numbers of different groups admitted year after year after year reveal that there is a secret quota system?
Mm-hmm. This group gets this percentage, this group gets this percentage, and it hasn't changed.
Yeah, it's pretty striking.
Mm-hmm. But in the affirmative action role and what it has done over the country, has maybe the process need to be changed as these different as we change, as the economy changes, as the country changes, still affirmative action, but maybe the process a bit different.
Yes, and an incubator for that different process is the states that there are, I think, about eight of them now that have banned affirmative action through legislation or popular referendum, like California, Michigan, Florida. And those universities have been forced to look for other ways of accomplishing diversity, and it has been a struggle.
Oh, it has.
You know, there's no perfect method. Socioeconomic status is often a proxy for being, let's say, Black or Hispanic, or in some cases Asian, I would think. Stuyvesant High School in New York City, most of the kids are Asian, and I believe that most of them are also on free lunch, an indicator of poverty. So there are other things you can look at, like socioeconomic status, but it's obviously not as precise a way of doing it as if you could just look at race as a factor.
And do you think the Department of Justice will look at affirmative action because of what's been going on with, say, the Harvards of the world, or is this something that the Trump administration is pushing?
I don't think we know the answer to whether it's something that the Trump administration is pushing. I think to some degree these things are cyclical, and, you know, the Obama administration was presumably more sympathetic to affirmative action than the evidence shows that it was, than the Trump administration. I don't think we have strong evidence at this point on the Trump administration. The fact is that the Harvard complaint was filed in 2015 during the Obama administration. It was dismissed by the Education Department. It was filed there through their Civil Rights Office, and it was languishing in the Justice Department. So, you know, now it's being picked up. Make of that what you will.
And I think for the student, it is frustrating at times when they really do strive to get those SAT, ACT scores and do the extracurriculars that they're supposed to do to get into the elite colleges and have that GPA over 4 point, and yet it's still an elusive admission to them.
Well, so here's what the students say and what the complaint says. You're Asian American. The statistics, some research by a professor out of Princeton has shown that Asian Americans have to score 140 points higher than whites, the next highest scoring group, on the SAT in order to be admitted to private elite institutions. Then you go down the scale, they have to score even a bigger differential for other racial groups. The study doesn't address that, but the complaint says they're often counseled by their guidance counselors not to appear too Asian. You know, don't say you play the violin, don't say you play tennis, don't put your photo on.
Wow.
Don't emphasize that your family came over on a boat from Vietnam. So in the lawsuit, one of the things that the plaintiffs have sought is admissions records from both Harvard and certain feeder high schools with large Asian populations. They want to look not only at the numbers, but at those soft factors.
We will follow this and see where it goes. Thank you so much, Anna Mona Harder-Colas, joining us this morning to discuss affirmative action, a national correspondent for higher education at the New York Times. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. A coalition of Asian Americans is suing Harvard University, alleging that it and other Ivy League institutions hold Asian American applicants to higher standards in the college admissions process. According to reports by the New York Times, this lawsuit is part of a U.S. Justice Department initiative to take a harder look at affirmative action policies. Although the DOJ is neither confirming nor denying the existence of potential investigations, it has nonetheless renewed the debate over race-based admissions. Joining me by phone is contributing editor for the National Journal and co-author of several books, including The Campus Rape Frenzy, The Attack on Due Process at America's Universities, and his 2012 book, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Stuart Taylor, Jr. Stuart, thank you for joining me this morning.
For having me.
Also by phone, associate professor at Harvard University in the Graduate School of Education, Natasha Warrico. She specializes in education, racial and ethnic diversity, and cultural processes in schools and universities. She's the author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy. There I go, at elite universities. Welcome, Natasha.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you both. Let's start with the Supreme Court recently upheld affirmative action in the case of Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin. Natasha, what can you tell us about this case?
Yeah, so this is a case where, you know, there have been multiple cases since 1978 attempting to critique affirmative action for race-based discrimination. And in each of these cases, the court has upheld affirmative action and has said that a compelling state interest is a diversity of students on campus, so that in order to have a diverse student body with a lot of different viewpoints in which everyone benefits from, that diversity is a good, is an okay reason to have affirmative action. So it's upheld it. I think what the last decision did, so there was actually Fisher 1 and Fisher 2, the court actually heard this case twice, which I think made clear that there's going to be a little more scrutiny around whether universities need to be able to show that they have tried all other race-neutral alternatives to race-based affirmative action. And only if they can show that can they then have a race-based policy. And so there's a little bit of a kind of tightening and a closer look than I think in the past they were kind of given the benefit of the doubt that they had already tried those race-neutral alternatives. And now they're being expected to be able to show it if they are taken to court.
So this case does make a little different process, pushes that anyway, from previous affirmative action cases?
It's, you know, again, it remains to be seen. There, you know, most legal scholars say that affirmative action will be back in the Supreme Court at some point, and it remains to be seen how the judges, how much the judges expect universities to be able to show that they've tried, you know, all other race-neutral alternatives.
Going back in history of affirmative action, why and when was it established in the U.S.?
So affirmative action came up first, you know, from the federal government, President Kennedy and then President Johnson basically called for affirmative action in government contracts. And, you know, around the same time in the early 1960s, private universities, elite universities, saw, you know, race riots around them. They also wanted to be seen as kind of forward-thinking in terms of race relations in the United States. This is a pivotal moment in the United States. And so, and they recognized that, you know, African Americans had been systematically excluded from their universities, or universities, many were built on the backs of slave labor, and that there was a huge racial inequality problem in the United States. And this was one means of them saying, you know what, we're going to fix this. We're going to right these wrongs, and we're going to fix this historical exclusion and this underrepresentation on our campuses. And that's really where it started in the 1960s. And it started growing on these elite campuses, and then, you know, brought more and more universities took up this policy of affirmative action.
So, Stuart, historically, has it been that the goal has been to give economically disadvantaged students a chance at a college education and not as much race regarded, more economically regarded?
I think that was part of the goal when it started in the late 60s, 70s. But that's sort of disappeared from most colleges' policies. Most of them use very large racial preferences for African Americans and somewhat smaller ones for their selective universities for Hispanic Americans. Most of them, it's alleged, and I think plausibly, discriminate against Asian Americans, as you know, especially because they don't want to have too many of them. And the Asian Americans are such outstanding students that they're afraid that a merit-based policy would have more Asian Americans than they want. One interesting thing about the phrase affirmative action, it was mentioned how President Kennedy and Johnson sort of first popularized it in this area. At the time they used those words, they had nothing to do with racial preferences. Their executive orders said no racial discrimination, period. Not against and not for racial minorities. That's changed. The words affirmative action, I think much of the public doesn't really understand this, but as used by the universities, affirmative action means almost exclusively racial preferences for Black and Hispanic students, and often against Asian students, and sometimes against white students. And although I think the value of diversity is pretty widely accepted, I accept it, the question is, how much diversity is it worth to completely throw aside merit when you're talking about admissions? And the hardest thing about it, I think the way our book most criticized the policy, is not that it discriminated against whites so much or even Asians so much. It does, but I'm not sure the harm to whites is that great. It's that it harms the supposed beneficiaries, because the racial preferences used by universities are so large, and I can give you some numbers on that, that many Black students in particular, who are good students, are thrown into competition against brilliant students at the most competitive universities in the country and are set up for struggle and failure academically. In the long run, this seems to me, in many cases, bad for them, not good for them.
Oh, we'll get back to that in a moment. Go ahead, Natasha. Yes, please.
Can I jump in on this question of class? Because I think that, you know, when we think about broadening the class diversity of these universities, we can go back to pre-affirmative action. We have the GI Bill, right? So the GI Bill was a bill that provided scholarships for GIs returning from World War II. And this is a great means of social mobility, but this was predominantly for white returnees. And this was because the government never added a non-discrimination clause into that law, right? So African Americans were largely needed to take these scholarships and go to historically Black colleges and universities, which had limited space. And so when we talk about a class-based mechanism for promoting diversity in higher education at a time, you know, at this time of greater higher education expansion in the late 1950s, there was a class-based policy, but it systematically excluded African Americans. And that predates affirmative action, which was race-based. So I really think we need to disentangle class and race in this debate. I mean, both of these are huge issues and big problems. You know, elite universities are have very low numbers of working class and poor students, disproportionately wealthy, upper middle class students. So I think this is an important issue, and I don't want to minimize it. But I also think we need to separate that from the race question, which, you know, there's been this historic exclusion. There are many ways that race operates as independent of class in the United States. And we've had, you know, many supposedly race-neutral policies like the GI Bill over the 20th century that have systematically excluded African Americans. And this is just one small piece of that of mechanism to, address this issue.
I'm sorry. I just want to let folks know who we're talking to here as they're listening. This is All Sides, and we are talking with Stuart Taylor Jr., contributing editor for the National Journal, and Natasha Warrico, an associate professor at Harvard University in the Graduate School of Education. And the topic is affirmative action. Stuart, go ahead.
What she said is true, but some other things are true that I think put it in perspective. One, for more than 30 years, systematic racial preferences in favor of Black and Hispanic and some other minority students have been the norm. The history of discrimination against Blacks and Asians in admissions, I don't mean Asians, against Blacks and Hispanics, is, you know, no doubt true, but it's long ago history, and it's kind of, you know, the more relevant history, I think, is the history today of discrimination in favor of Blacks and Hispanics. In addition, I think it's true that you should disentangle analytically the race and the class issue. And one reason is there's a mistaken impression in some quarters that racial preferences for Black and Hispanic students are benefit to lower class, less wealthy Black and Hispanic students. By and large, that's not true. The Black and Hispanic students who get racial preferences are usually relatively affluent, and they get racial preferences in many cases over Asian and blue-collar white students who are actually better qualified academically. Now, why is that true?
Overall, Black and Latino students on elite college campuses have receive more financial aid and are from less wealthy families than their white peers. So while it's true that they are not, you know, they're more likely to, you know, they're not all poor, they're also less wealthy than their white peers on campus. And I think we also have to remember that there's an intergenerational kind of issue of wealth in the United States. And so, you know, African Americans, like white Americans and Asian Americans are incredibly diverse in terms of social class. But in terms of, you know, where people, residential segregation, we still have ongoing residential segregation. African American families who earn $100,000 a year live in similar kind of social class neighborhoods as whites who earn $30,000 a year. So we have systematic ways that race, aside from class, affect African Americans in the United States. So I think there is this intersection between race and class that we have to think really carefully about how it affects, you know, how the lives of, say, you know, middle class or upper middle class African Americans are different from middle class and upper class whites, and the same is true for the working class and the poor.
I have a question I want to pose to both of you, and I'll start with Stuart first on this one and then Natasha for you. One argument we hear sometimes is that affirmative action harms minorities, but then we hear how affirmative action helps everyone. Can you explain these two schools of thought?
Yes. I thought I was going to be answering.
Go ahead, Stuart.
Well, on harms minorities, you know, there's no universal rule. It harms some minorities. It helps others. But in this sense, and this is the main point of my 2012 book, 12-12 book Mismatch, the racial preferences that are used to try and reach the targets, especially for Black students that the universities set for themselves, the selective universities, are so large. For example, the average SAT gap that an Asian student would have to overcome. An Asian student needs 450 more SAT points out of 1,600, according to the best available study, to be competitive with an otherwise academically qualified Black student. Those gaps are huge, and the consequences of them is often harmful to the African Americans, because African Americans who would do very well at many universities, many selective universities, may not be competitive with the most brilliant students at the very top universities. And so you put them in the very top universities without warning them that they're going to have trouble being competitive. And we've seen lots of individual cases and lots of statistical evidence. They struggle. They often struggle. They do badly. Not everyone, but often. Now, the idea that it's beneficial to everyone is a whole different argument, which is diversity of experience in college. It's good to get to know a whole lot of different people. But the question is, yes, that's a good policy, and we have a lot of diversity, but how far do you want to compromise academic standards in order to get more diversity? And I think we've probably overdone that.
Natasha?
I want to address this question of mismatch, because we have a lot of social science evidence right now that shows that looks at this question very carefully. And so you might find, two things can be true. It can be true that, say, Black or Latino students might have a slightly lower graduation rate from a university. And it can also be true, and it is also true, that if they are beneficiaries of affirmative action, they are still more likely to graduate if they are than if they go to a college where, say, they're closer to the average in terms of students. And here's why. So there's research that kind of looks at students who, say, have lower than the median SAT score in their college and what their graduation rates are, and compares that to students with a similar SAT score, but at a lower status university. And the student in the higher status university is more likely to graduate. And this is because those higher status universities have better resources, more supports for students, and, you know, higher graduation rates overall. So it's so overall that those students are going to benefit. So yes, not, you know, there may be a few students who falter, just like there are students of all races who falter in higher education. But overall, the numbers very clearly and across a number of studies show that beneficiaries of affirmative action are actually better off at the higher status university than if they had gone to the data is very clear about whether they would are more likely to graduate or not. And so, you know, and we can see the effects of this in the United States in terms of, you know, leadership. I remember when Barack Obama was running for president in, and I was living in Britain, all the British, you know, British people were saying, well, where's, you know, how, why do we not have a minorities in the same position, you know, about to someone who might run for president. And part of this is affirmative action in the United States. And again, this is at the very elite level, right? This is not addressing, you know, large-scale, black poverty. But this is talking about our leadership. And so, you know, I think that this question of mismatch, that, you know, the data is pretty clear that students are overall are better off at the higher status university, even if they have lower SAT scores than their average white peers or Asian peers. I don't know if this is an appropriate time to kind of address this question of Asian Americans in affirmative action. But
we can.
I did want to say something about that.
We will take a break. And when we come back, we will continue more with affirmative action with that focus on Asian Americans. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about race and affirmative action in higher education. Still with us, associate professor in the Graduate School of Education at Harvard University and author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities, Natasha Waraku. Also journalist and co-author of Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It, Stuart Taylor Jr. Thank you all for joining us. And I'd also like to make sure that folks know that they can also call in with comments and questions to us, 614-292-8513. You can also email us, allsides@wosu.org. This question of Asian Americans in Harvard University was brought up before the break, Natasha, and the question is about a lawsuit filed by a group of Asian Americans against Harvard. And I'm going to start by playing a short clip of Swan Lee. She's an organizer of the coalition accusing Harvard of racial discrimination. Let's listen.
If one group of students are held to higher standards based on their appearance, I mean, that's not right.
That's just part of what the lawsuit is about. And Asian American students are alleging that they need to be held to a higher standard and that there's a certain number that Harvard allows each year, and that's the number. So, Natasha, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's really important, in this debate to separate this question of Asian American discrimination from the question of affirmative action. So the question of affirmative action is really, should there be some provision based on race in order to, you know, have, representation of African Americans and Latinos on campus? Sometimes the argument is made that, in order to rectify discrimination or racial inequality? So that's one question, right? And remember that, you know, these universities, Harvard admits like around 5% of it of applicants. So for every 19 white students rejected, you know, all of them, if there's one Black student admitted, 19 are going to feel it's due to affirmative action. So I think that's one issue. I think a separate issue is whether Asian Americans are being held to a higher standard than whites. Now, there's no historical discrimination against whites at Harvard University or any, you know, elite university in the United States. And so there's no reason that I can think of that we would say, well, we need a certain number of, you know, we need to keep the number of whites on campus more or less. We can't go well under 50%, right? We can't have too many Asians on this campus, right? That, to me, does not make any sense. And so the extent to which there might be, I don't know if there is, but if there is anti-Asian discrimination, to me, that is vis-a-vis whites. Whites are still, you know, I know there's the headlines of, you know, Harvard is now like just under 50% white, but it's still, you know, around 50% white. Okay. So, you know, vis-a-vis whites, there's no reason why we would need to protect that 50% and not get it any lower or make Asian Americans, you know, stay under like 25%. Because why is a campus that's half white okay, but a campus that's half Asian not okay? To me, that reeks of racial discrimination. That is a very different question as the question of, you know, African Americans and Latinos vis-a-vis whites. You know, it's almost as if this debate suggests that the number of seats for white
Gail, I thought this is going to be a dialogue.
The racial minorities
what it is
have
is a filibuster. I'm not sure I want to continue on this basis.
And Stuart,
Asian minorities have to vie for the same
spot. She's talking on and on and on and on. And you keep going back to her. What's the reason for that, Gail?
I was just going to hand it to you, Stuart. I'm sorry you feel that way. She just brought this up before the break, so I would go to her. But
and
go.
She brought it up before the break at the end of a very long filibuster about something else, and you went right back to her.
Go ahead.
As I disagree with pretty much everything Natasha has said. Let me touch on some of them. First, discrimination against whites. Certainly that's not historically true, but the usual meaning of racial discrimination is treating somebody worse based on their race. It's certainly true. That's what's called affirmative action today. Now, I think the main victims of this kind of affirmative action are not whites, they're Asians, because Asians perform so outstandingly and they're held back. Example, I think I began to mention this earlier, but the best study on the degree of racial preference is that for an Asian American to have an equal chance against a non-Asian applicant with otherwise comparable academic qualifications, the Asian needs about 450 SAT points out of 1,600, more than the Black student. The Asian needs 270 points more than a Hispanic. The Asian needs 140 points more than a white. And a white student needs 310 points more than a Black. That's prima facie evidence of huge discrimination. Let me go back briefly to what was said about graduation rates supposedly proving the merits of racial preferences. It's true that graduation rates at the most prestigious universities for racial preference recipients are pretty high. The reason is they graduate almost everyone. They hardly ever flunk out anyone. The real test of whether the Black students at the universities are the most prestigious ones who are there by large preferences are benefiting is how about their grades? How about their majors? How about the ones who wanted to be pre-med and who find that they can't pass the first-year chemistry course because their competitors in the class are way ahead of them, who could have done very well, could have done pre-med, could have become doctors if they'd gone to slightly less selected universities where they would be competitive with their classmates. And we have in our book individual cases like that. There's also lots of statistical evidence. Black kids who go, you know, the rate of Black kids starting college who want to major in the sciences is a little bit higher than the rate of white kids, but there are huge dropout rates, not out of college, but out of the sciences, because recipients of large preferences, any kind of preferences, racial or otherwise, struggle in competition with their classmates in the tough courses.
Are you putting a little bit of blame maybe on high school counselors or admissions counselors for not directing these students to the schools that they would benefit from?
I think there's something to that, but it's a lot. Frankly, there's enormous pressure on high school counselors to channel the students towards the most prestigious, most selective colleges that accept them, and I understand that. I think it's too bad. What we need in this country is not a whole lot of court orders, I think. What we need is wide public information about how these preferences work so that black families, for example, who are considering, you know, whether their child should go to the most prestigious place that recruits him or her, or should go to, you know, a very good school where he would be competitive with his classmates, you know, so that they know not only what the magnitude of the difference is in entering qualifications, so that they also know what some of the outcomes are, grades, science dropout, that sort of thing.
Natasha, what do we mean by diversity now? Has that idea changed?
You're breaking up. I'm sorry.
I said the idea of diversity, has it changed over time?
Absolutely, it has. You know, when affirmative action started in the 1960s, it was a means of dealing with racial inequality and racial injustice. And what happens over time is it kind of morphs into this idea of diversity, right? So in and it starts really with the Bakke decision in 1978, where you know, that was a affirmative action case that came to the Supreme Court, and the court was split, and Justice Powell said that, well, you, compelling state, the argument that was compelling to him was that the, you know, that diversity is important because it creates a diverse learning environment in which everyone benefits, and that could be shown. And so that, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, after that, there was a lot of social science research that shows a lot of benefit to this idea of diversity, right? And there's, you know, even now we always hear about teams and how diversity on teams makes them more creative. And so we know that there are a lot of positive effects of this. So this is, you know, this is, we might think, is a good thing on the one hand. On the other hand, we've sort of lost sight of this question of racial inequality, which I think can be problematic. And so, you know, I talk in my book about the ways that it affects the way students think about their peers on campus and why we have affirmative action. And then, you know, white students might say, okay, well, if, you know, black and Latino students are on our campus, you know, assuming they assume that they're all there because of affirmative action, then they should be, you know, integrating. So why are they joining the Black Students Association or sitting together in the cafeteria when, you know, for those minority students, those might be really important spaces where they kind of can, you know, have a kind of place to share life experiences or, you know, what have you, a support network.
So, Stuart, so, your ideas then on diversity, and has that idea changed? And to Natasha's point, where even in diverse campuses, yes, these students tend to go to clubs that are part of their culture.
Well, they do, and that's understandable, and I wouldn't fault them for doing it. But one of the causes of this, Peter Arcidiacono, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with pronunciation, Arcidiacono of Duke has done very interesting research showing that when you throw students of very wide gaps, racial gaps, or any kind of gaps in academic achievement among them, they tend to socialize with their academic peers. You don't see a lot of socializing between the students at the bottom of the class and the students at the top of the class. It's a little counterintuitive, but his research results are clear. I think that's a part of the explanation for why there's so much self-segregation within campuses. And I think, in fact, you might see more real racial mingling at a campus where you had perhaps a somewhat smaller number of blacks, but they were academically competitive with their peers, than you would at one with a somewhat larger but non-competitive contingent. Now, the history of diversity is interesting because compensatory justice, remedies for slavery, our history of slavery and segregation, that's what were the original reasons given for affirmative action. And what happened, what popularized diversity is the explanation, began with Justice Powell's pivotal opinion in the Bakke case in 1978 when he said, and nobody had argued this in the briefs, it kind of came out of the blue, he got it from, I think, some Harvard literature, that diversity of outlooks, diversity of opinions was a critical thing in education and that racial preferences could contribute to that. And there's something to that. It wasn't the original purpose. The problem is there's very little diversity of outlook at universities today, and racial preferences contribute very little to that, and the universities don't really seem to care much about intellectual diversity if you look at how many non-left-leaning professors they have. So diversity is a complicated argument, but I don't think it justifies throwing aside academic factors in order to try and get just the right percentages of each racial group.
I am going to take a phone call before we have to end this. This is Julie from Clintonville. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. I have listened to this discussion for the last 2 days, and I think it's interesting that there's so much discussion about discrimination and diversity at the college level when it exists all the way up to your entering college. And it seems to be there's some great economic gaps and academic gaps that children suffer or get to experience in a positive way, depending on finances. So I think yesterday they interviewed some white kids who were first-generation college attendees. These were children whose parents could not afford college. It seems like a funny time to devote so much energy and effort into creating parity in an educational setting at the college level when no one seems to want to address it earlier than that.
Julie, thank you for your comment. Stuart, Natasha, you want to take this?
Yeah, I think that's
Hello?
10 or 20 minutes.
Natasha, are you there? I'm sorry, we lost you for a moment.
I think that's an absolutely important point. And I wouldn't say that it's either or. You know, we absolutely need to address inequality in our K-12 system and in our society. You know, our schools, we have a lot of racial segregation in schools. We have class segregation as well. We have unequal opportunities for children. And so that's why I always emphasize that affirmative action is just one small piece of this very important big puzzle of equal opportunity in the United States. And in some ways that if we had a more equal, you know, class-wise and racially, race-wise system of, you know, childhood, then, you know, we would have less, you know, we would be debating affirmative action less because there people would have these opportunities. We wouldn't be rectifying we would be fixing the problem that we're trying to then rectify in higher education admission.
And, you know, Stuart, I'll let you answer. I think maybe this is another bigger discussion for another day.
It is. But Julie makes a great point. I mean, I think the heart of the problem with American education is not racial preferences in college. That's a problem. It's worth talking about. But the heart of the problem is that we have, first, our K-12 schools are pretty weak internationally, if you do internationally comparisons. And second, the K-12 education of black children, both at home and at school, as shown by test scores and all kinds of other measures, is catastrophically behind that of Asians especially, and also whites. And that's why that's why you have this large demand for racial affirmative action. It's the only way to get diversity, because the pool of black kids who come out of high school well qualified for elite colleges is tiny, and the pool of Asians is huge. And so if you're trying to social engineer certain ratios of different races in college, the K-12 results are going to be a huge obstacle to doing that, and that's why we've tortured ourselves over how much racial preference needs to be used to get to the right level of diversity. It would happen automatically if the kids coming out of 12th grade were more or less proportionately strong or weak academically across racial groups.
I think this is something, affirmative action and how you've both described it, that will continue to be tweaked, not probably go away. Do you both agree?
Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think it's a work in progress.
In particular, I think what the Justice Department is now doing may take the direction of focusing on the still operative absolute ban the Supreme Court has long declared on racial quotas.
Well,
and if you can show there are racial quotas for Asians,
we will watch and see. Stuart Taylor Jr., thank you. Contributing editor for the National Journal and co-author of Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. And Natasha Wariku, an associate professor at Harvard University in the Graduate School of Education, the author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Thank you both for joining us. This is All Sides on WOSU.